right, every Wednesday in the third hour of the program, well, almost every Wednesday, we always invite him, at least. He's not always available, but we love it when he is, and so do you. He's a professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. He's the author of Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Your Health. And the sequel to that book is Don't Cross Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. You should get those books. They're great. Also, read his blog. It's always very active on the blog, The Incidental Economist, and there's lots of blog entries that I want to talk with him about today. And on Twitter, most importantly, give him follows on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll, two R's, two L's. Good day to you, sir.
Hey, how are you?
I'm excellent. I'll be coming out there. I'm trying to figure it out.
It's in April, right?
In April. I'm looking for that date right now. I'm a little unorganized.
Looking forward to it.
Morty's Comedy Joint in Indianapolis. I will be staying at Che Carroll.
Woo!
Looking forward to that. Very nice guest room there. Last time I was there, I had pink eye.
Oh, you did.
In the guest room.
I thought you were making a joke. I remember you did. That's right. Yes.
It was the weirdest thing to be on stage and have my eye flooded with fluid at all times.
Yes. And I remember, like, luckily I have lots of doctor friends who could offer you lots of advice.
Yeah, that's for sure. Speaking of advice, let's start with the stats about childhood obesity. There's a lot of nuance and a lot of question, and you're critical of some things here.
Literally seconds before I got on the phone, yes.
Just saw your tweets, and I'm curious as to, okay, so what's the big news?
Well, it's funny because it's like every news story I read is losing its mind about the fact that, like, obesity dropped dramatically in 2 to 5 year olds. And so I went to go read the study just this morning before I got on, and if you read the study, you would have no idea that there was any good news, you know, at all. I mean, I'm sort of baffled by all this. I was just looking at the study itself, and I mean, here's the conclusion of the study. Overall, there have been no significant changes in obesity prevalence in youth or adults between 2003 and 2004 and 2011-2012. Obesity prevalence remains high, and thus it is important to continue surveillance. And I'm like, what? And so I went through, and I'm like, you know, they go through, they break it out by age groups and all this stuff, and even when they look at infants and toddlers, no changes. When they look at 2 to 19 year olds, no changes. When they look at adults, no changes. Only when they tease out, I think it was like 2 to 5 year olds, then they see a real reduction, and no reduction in the kids that are younger, no reduction in the kids that are older. And again, if you look at over 6 year olds, it goes up. So it's like as they got down smaller and smaller, finally they found a significant reduction. This would be like finding one guy and saying, hey, Dave lost weight. I just don't understand why, you know, we're touting this. It's like if you keep doing statistical tests, eventually you're going to find something that's significantly different by chance alone. And it looks like, yes, 2 to 5 year olds' weight dropped, you know, pretty dramatically, like by 43%. But the 6 year olds are the same and the 1 year olds are the same. So it sort of doesn't make any sense to me. And the main take home point of the study, as it was written, was, yeah, obesity is still a major problem and we haven't really seen any significant changes. But, you know, of course, as the media always goes, you would never know that reading any of the news stories.
That's disappointing. I
know.
Thought we
well,
had something
like,
to be happy about.
I would love to be happy about this, but I just don't, you know, when the main conclusion of the study reads like, hey, you know what, things are as bad today as they were a decade ago, why every news story is leading with this wonderful news that, like, kids are no longer fat is somewhat baffling.
Well, but your initial reaction, at least in a tweet yesterday afternoon, was, everyone, the news about childhood obesity going down is good, but we need to keep them from getting obese later, problem
right.
Not solved. Because...
Well,
because
yeah, 2 to 5 year olds are all, the 6 year olds are still obese, as are the adults, as is everybody else. And the idea that if you're thin at 2 to 5, you will be thin for the rest of your life is not true. Of course, you know, most babies are born, you know, not already obese, and yet they become obese. Not all toddlers are obese, and lots become obese. You know, it's a lifetime run, and just solving the problem in 2 to 5, even if it was real. And I'm not yet convinced that there is, like, this major, you know, culture shift in 2 to 5 year olds. But even if it was significant that 2 to 5 year olds were doing better, that does not mean, like, we've won this. As I said before, 60-year-olds are getting worse. Adults are still majorly obese. Nothing has really changed holistically in our diets. Like, I need to see that changing for everybody, not just for 2 to 5 year olds, who, of course, won't stay 2 to 5 forever. So, you know, I just, everybody was sort of saying, like, yes, this is over. You know, look, at we've won. It's like, no, we haven't. Now that I've actually looked at the study itself, I'm even less thrilled. I just don't see this major change that everybody seems to be touting in the media.
Yesterday we had a former drug warrior on, well, continued drug warrior, who told us that the AMA says there are no medical benefits to marijuana. And so then somebody sent me the abstract from the study from the AMA. And I read it, and the AMA, I think they've changed their tune on it. And they said the results of the study, the conclusions are, results of short-term controlled trials indicate that smoked cannabis reduces neuropathic pain, improves appetite and caloric intake, especially in patients with reduced muscle mass, and may relieve spasticity and pain in patients with multiple sclerosis. Now, I've not, you know, read a study, I've not conducted a study, but anecdotally, we certainly hear that marijuana can serve as a painkiller. It can serve as an appetite incentive. And I've heard over and over that it really, really seems to be the only thing to help people with MS.
Right.
But what do we know?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Well, first of all, this is something I'd have to go look, because I have not poured into the actual.
How dare you not be an expert on
this issue. Here's the thing. I have no trouble believing that there's a limited amount of what the AMA would consider peer-reviewed, you know, big-time randomized controlled trials. Because, of course, up until recently, it would have been completely illegal to run a study. And I cannot imagine the government approving it. I cannot imagine the NIH funding it. I cannot imagine any private industry funding it. So it doesn't surprise me that there probably isn't a nice, large, randomized controlled trial of marijuana to show that it has major benefit on people who have chronic illness. And in the same way that the tobacco companies can get away forever by saying that it's never been proven that smoking causes cancer, because we will never have a randomized controlled trial of smoking to see if it causes cancer, the AMA can therefore get away with saying, well, we have no way of proving that marijuana, you know, causes all these benefits, because we have no large randomized controlled trial to prove that there are all these benefits. Having said that, it's legal in a lot of places now. There's no reason we couldn't do that study, and I, for one, would support it. I think marijuana proponents should support it, because they should have nothing to fear. Either marijuana is going to really work in the way that we think it's going to work, in which case let's have these studies to finally prove it and end this debate. Or, you know, I try to be always, you know, have equipoise. If it turns out that marijuana doesn't, then we should know that too. There's no reason we can't do those studies today. Given the fact that marijuana is becoming legal, just flat out, in certain states, and certainly medical marijuana is legal in certain states, it's time to stop arguing about this, and let's just do some good studies.
So to those who would argue with you on using an anecdote, and you could use a million of them, but they say, listen, I've got MS, and I've tried every single drug my doctor suggested, but marijuana is the only one that, what is it? Relaxes my muscles. What does MS do? I've tried every drug, and I'm getting addicted to this one, and that one's expensive. But marijuana is the only one that increases my appetite or decreases my nausea. Marijuana is the only thing that calms my mind, that allows me to focus. What I mean to those people that say I've tried all these drugs, they don't work, but somehow when I smoke marijuana or ingest marijuana, Marinol or whatever it might be, that seems to be the solution for me. And I think it's always most interesting when it's the older person who's never in a million years considered smoking marijuana, and then they try it and it's a game changer.
Okay, here's the thing. I'll say the same. I'm luckily I get to be consistent. I'll say the same thing I always say. It's the United States of America. You do what you like. I am not telling anyone not to use their own money and to go and purchase the things that make them happy and do this. You know, some people like to have a drink at night, so be it. You buy your alcohol, you drink. Some people like to smoke. I think it's terribly unhealthy, but you go buy your cigarettes and you smoke until they make it illegal. If marijuana is legal, I have no problem. In the same way, I have no problem with people using their money for any over-the-counter drug or anything else if people want to purchase it. You'll hear me say stop when we start talking about making it public policy or start making it public money that has to buy this stuff. Because at that point, I want to see some solid evidence. And so if we're going to enact policy that says all insurance plans have to cover medical marijuana, then I want to know what medical marijuana actually works for and what it doesn't work for. because I only want to spend public money, and even when I say public money, I mean insurance premiums, everyone's money, on stuff that is proven to work, whether it comes from the pharmaceutical company or whether it comes from the ground or whether it comes from a crop. I do not care. I only want to spend everyone's money on stuff that is proven to work. So if we're pushing for medical marijuana to be covered by insurance or to be covered by government insurance or private insurance or anything else, then I want to know for what indications, and I want to know that it works, and I want nice trials to do it. But if people want to go and take their own hard-earned cash and go use it, then that's their right. That's their right to do it with herbs. That's their right to do it with tea. That's their right to do it with marijuana if it is legal. That is perfectly fine. I may stand on the side and sort of shake my head at you wistfully and say, you know, there's no proof of that, and then I think you're wasting your money, but that's fine.
Because you're a judgmental bastard.
Money all over the place. That's, you know, that is just what we do. I'm sure I buy lots of stuff that makes me happy that I'm sure people think is a complete waste of money. That's my right, and I don't want to be judged on
that
either.
What is something that you've purchased that makes you happy that other people think is a waste of money?
My massive comic book collection, I am sure, including Amy, probably thinks this is a massive waste of money, but I like it. I like my video games. I like, you know, there are things that we all like.
Will you read the iPad on a tablet, or do you need the hard copy? Will you read the comic book on a tablet?
No, I really like to have them in my hand.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But, you know, I like fancy food once in a while. There's lots of stuff that I'm sure.
Has your wife ever said to you, I would like to make love, put down that comic book, and you said,
never.
I've really got to finish
never.
This comic book? You've never
no.
said, I've got to finish this Spider-Man?
No, in the ranking of things, that would always be ahead of comic.
Just want to make sure that we're on the same page.
Don't
all right, because some people would suggest
Don't
those who read
worry.
Comic books are sexless, and I wanted to make sure that wasn't
no.
a stereotype that was accurate about our good friend. Dr. Aaron Carroll, who you can join the conversation with, 866-994-6343. And we have no calls yet, and I'm glad we don't, because I have a ton of things to get through with you before I open it to, it is open right now. Anybody wants a call, but I want to make sure I get to, usually the calls are locked, but we haven't got anything maybe too controversial yet. And I'm not even trying to do that, because we're not trying to purposely be provocative on this program, but often things do get that way when we're talking about healthcare and when we're talking about health policy and so on, as we do with Dr. Carroll. Now, we got to ask you about acetaminophen and ADHD. Could Tylenol in pregnancy be linked to ADHD in children? New study out in the Journal of American Medicine. You write for them. JAMA Pediatrics says, too early to make recommendations for the public just yet, but what is this about?
Well, they keep doing large studies, one to look at the things that cause ADHD and two to look at things that drugs have side effects on. And then this is also a subtle point that's always important to remember, that there's a difference between, you know, associations and causation. This is the same kind of thing. Like they're showing there's an association between women taking Tylenol in pregnancy and then their kids later developing ADHD. And this is causing many of my friends to freak out. I don't know why, since their kids are already older and don't have ADHD. But regardless, it's a problem nonetheless. And so this is where I always...
And they don't have a time machine.
No, exactly. And not only that, I'm always like, your kid doesn't have ADHD. You're not getting pregnant anymore. I don't understand why this is an issue. But anyway, not to talk about them. But look...
Name those friends right now.
No,
full names
will not,
and addresses.
We'll not do that.
Okay,
so anyway, you have to always... You know, remember that you know there's association and there's causation, and you know the same way that like there have been studies, some produced by people I know and respect, that show that watching TV is associated with developing ADHD, and of course the question then becomes, well, is it the TV that causes ADHD, or is it the ADHD that makes them want to watch more TV? And they have no answer, because it's just an association. Is it, you know, something about mothers who therefore feel pain or something like that, who want to take drugs, who then develop, have kids with ADHD? Or is it that mothers, you know, who are more focused on their pain might have more means and therefore take drugs for it and then later notice that their kids have ADHD? No one knows what this is. Additionally, we're not talking about huge changes in absolute risk. It's not as if a kid goes from having a 1% chance of having ADHD to a 20% chance of having ADHD. They're statistically significant, but very subtle, tiny risks.
Well,
plus, again, you always have to weigh the risks and the benefits. It's like there's risks from everything, and there's harms and there's benefits to everything, and we enough to say one way or the other, you know, what is gonna happen. And every time we try to focus in on one specific thing and another specific thing and say they're linked and we shouldn't do one because it's going to cause the other, well, not doing that one could have other effects. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying, if my wife was pregnant still and she was in pain, I would not even blink if she took Tylenol.
I wonder, and you've educated me and others on this a number of times, but you have to wonder about the diagnosis of any ailment and any disease, and when we say, well, there's been a rash or there's been an explosion in autism, in ADD, ADHD, there's been an explosion in post-traumatic PTSD and veterans. And you always have to ask yourselves, as we learn from you, has there been an increase in explosion, or are we just now diagnosing it differently or more or specifically differently? So you'll see a chart, and you'll see stats blow up on an issue, on an ailment, on a disease, et cetera. But you always have to ask, are we now just diagnosing it differently, or is there actually a brand new epidemic of this that's really increased exponentially in a short period of time? So when we've talked about autism, we've talked about PTSD often, we talk about veterans issues, but on ADD and ADHD, which is they're a little bit different, it does seem to be the case that we're seeing far more of that now in our kids today. Anecdotally, it certainly seems to be that case, and it's very easy for us to say that's because of the explosion of screens and screen time, and they're constantly being bombarded with images. They're always distracted. They have no time to de-stress, to be quiet, to be mindful, to meditate, to just read, etc. Is there an explosion in ADD, ADHD, or are we just measuring it differently?
Well, I think part of it is that it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. It's like, is there an explosion? Probably not. Are we measuring it differently, and are we calling different things ADHD, and are we picking up on it better? All of those things are true. But here's the thing that gets interesting. It's at some point, you know, children, if ADHD was becoming this scourge, we would expect to see a change in these, you know, in the adult population as well. I mean, a significant change. And I don't just mean even a change in numbers, but we would expect to see a change in the way that we're living. And that we would know more and more adults who also had ADHD, who also had real social problems. That's not happening as much, which either means that kids always outgrow it, or that, you know, some of them are being diagnosed and it's not as significant as it was, and it turns out as they grow, they just learn to manage it on their own. And that we don't know. But, you know, we keep blaming things for ADHD, and we keep blaming external factors, and of course we always blame the things that people want to fight about, taking drugs or the fact that, like, you know, there's much more screen time. I don't know if you saw, I tweeted like a week ago, somebody as a joke, but, you know, to make a point, overlaid the increase in uptake and sales of organic food and the increase in diagnosis of autism, and made it so that, you know, that the two lines were exactly the same. You know, as if proving that as we eat more and more organic food, that's what's causing autism. Completely don't believe that's the case. That's not the case. Look, I'm saying up front, that's not the case. But you can show a graph that shows as organic food is taken off, autism is taken off. Because, of course, these are secular trends. And yes, I can show that as computers take off, that's when ADHD took off. They're secular trends. In the same way, I can say, as, you know, acetaminophen took off, that's when brain cancer took off. And these things happen sometimes at the same time, or even one phone, that doesn't mean that one caused the other. And so we don't have in sort of prospective trials, which again could be done, any kind of evidence that shows that any one of these things is causing the other. When something causes something else, like thalidomide in pregnancy causing terrible birth defects, you notice it fast, it's horrible, the second we stop doing it, the thing goes away. That's like known, real, proven, we got to do something about that. These other things, they're sort of soft, and they're at the edges, and we have no idea whether they provide harms or benefits or what's going on. And it's very difficult to tease out whether we have, you know, more harm or more benefit, or more benefit or more harm. And I think that the take-home point from that piece, if you actually read it, was that not to say, like, we should get pregnant women to stop taking acetaminophen, but to say, like, you know what, we don't do a very good job in testing a lot of drugs to know what they're doing in pregnancy. And we still sort of like wave our hands at that and aren't very thorough about it. And maybe we should rethink about changing that policy. That I completely agree with. And I think we could do a lot better job with the FDA and with trying to provide oversight and understand what's going on with this. But in general, you know, it's very hard to read the media and get a sense of what's going on with actual research. It's hard to even sometimes read the articles and get a sense of what's going on with actual research. But it stuns me sometimes about how, you know, the media will latch on to one tiny piece of the story and make a huge deal out of it, and then, of course, move on to the next one. Everyone starts to panic, and when you go and you tease into it, there just isn't much there at all.
Yeah, because, you, I mean, that's the great thing about having you, access the access we have to someone like you that can – you know, every day I saw Jake Tapper, CNN, tweet out, new study says, and I didn't even click on the link. I don't know, but I mean, it's very easy for anybody, to conduct a study. It's very easy for, my wife just says, I took Tylenol for a week every 4 hours when I was pregnant with Julia.
Right.
Cause she had the flu when she was 11 weeks pregnant. But again, no concern there.
Right. Well, what concern? Your daughter's growing up to be perfect. Like, why would you worry? It's like, and not only that, there's 10 gazillion things which are...
I wouldn't say she's perfect. I mean, a shiny object is quite a distraction.
But 10 gazillion things that will influence and impact her life. To focus on one thing that Val was taking while she was in utero at this point is just not realistic.
It's funny that my wife never, ever mentions her heroin addiction during that pregnancy. did that go out on the air? Mark in South Dakota.
Hello, Peter. Hello, Dr. Carroll. How are you the guys this morning?
Good.
Fine.
Fantastic.
Thank
you. Dr. Carroll, I have a question for you. I'm a special education teacher, and I'm wondering if the increased diagnosis in kids with ADHD and those, and possibly even autism, has anything to do with the amount of information available now to the parents when they go to research prior to going into a psychiatrist to get an official diagnosis. I'm wondering if just a parent or an adult that knows the child, if they know the right things to say.
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, again, it's like there's probably, if callers keep calling up, everything you're going to say, I'm going to say is part of it, because it all is. You know, the fact that people are more educated about these illnesses and therefore even watching for them makes them more likely to be diagnosed, because these are not like you take a blood test and you get diagnosed. This is you notice some issues, someone makes a judgment, and it gets done. And if you had a child at home that you're like, well, he doesn't seem quite right, but whatever, I have no idea what it is, and you just go on with your life versus another parent who says, I just saw a piece in the news about, you know, a certain, you know, developmental delay. I'm going to take him in and be evaluated, and then you go in, and it turns out that, like, well, now we'll give him this label. That makes a difference. We often do these studies by combing through medical records, too. As doctors become more aware of it, they're more likely to use the billing code for it. That means it's being diagnosed more. I would say in a number of states, autism has become such a big issue that now there are laws passed that say, you know, every child who has autism is guaranteed to get X number of dollars of services, and it only exists for autism. And this makes it more likely that if you have a child that you believe needs services and has issues, you're tempted, even if it's subconsciously, to give them a diagnosis of autism because you know it's going to guarantee them to get certain services they won't get if you give them another diagnosis. And that has been shown to increase the number of diagnoses. There's a lot of reasons why these things become more and more prevalent.
Well, I know a frustration for just me, just ethically, is that a psychiatrist will see a kid, you know, quarterly for, you know, a quote-unquote med check. And I know that they do as good a job as maybe they can on that basis, you know, because that's all they're possibly allowed to bill for. And I don't know if that's the case in other states, but in South Dakota, I believe it's only quarterly med checks that they have to do. And I don't know, just to rely on what a parent says sometimes is, I don't know, a little bit questionable, I guess.
They should do more testing than that. I mean, if we for instance, for autism, we do surveillance and screening in the pediatrician's office. And if a child has a test that comes back positive, then we send them out for referral where, like, we're specialists, developmental specialists, are supposed to do much more rigorous testing and then determine if the child has autism. So it's not just a parent report and it's over.
No,
Having
no,
said
and,
that...
And I,
It's subjective. It is subjective in the sense that we try to make it as objective as possible, but it is not like having cancer where you do a test and like, or again, I should say, it's not like being pregnant where you pee on a stick and if it turns one color, it's one, and if it doesn't, it's another. It's subtle. And it's now
it's
a spectrum.
We have a urine test for autism.
Well, we did, but it's
a spectrum
now.
I'm just kidding.
No, but it's not autism. Now it's even like a range. And so you could be on one end of the spectrum or the other end of the spectrum, and that makes it very subtle.
I guess I didn't mean to lump autism into the ADH thing, because we, you know, our autism clinic in Sioux Falls is fantastic. They do a great job. More so the ADHD thing is I think it's overdiagnosed sometimes here anyway, just because of the kind of reporting inconsistencies and things like that. So
the tragedy
for your
of ADHD.
Time, guys.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, thanks.
The tragedy of ADHD.
I got to go to school.
Go ahead, Alfred.
Aaron. Is that it's both over and underdiagnosed. I think that there's probably a segment of the population that where it is overdiagnosed and drugs are being used too much. But on the other hand, there are lots of kids who have issues that don't get picked up and aren't getting any kind of treatment who would seriously benefit from it. So, like many things, it's not just easy enough to say we're seeing too much of it or too little of it. It's probably both.
Do you keep pictures on your iPad and video?
I don't keep any pictures on my iPad. I do keep some videos. I mean, like videos like movies, but no, I don't.
I mean home videos that take yourself, because they take up.
I do on my phone, but not my iPad.
Do you have Mountain Lion on your, I hear there's problems with the Mavericks OS?
I'm like pretty much updated on everything and I've had no issues.
And you're using the latest Maverick?
I'm the guy that downloads it the day it comes out.
If I'm going to watch a movie on my iPad, if I'm going to I want to watch it on the big screen, so I play it off my iPad, but I watch it on my TV. Uh-huh. What is the best option? Mirroring, AirPlay mirroring?
Yeah, I mean, do you have an Apple TV?
Yeah.
Yeah, then that's probably what I would do.
As opposed to connecting my laptop with an HDMI cable to my TV.
Well, there's a third option too, but no, with the iPad I would just use, if you have Apple TV, then mirroring is probably your best.
No, but with my laptop, how would I do it?
With your laptop, you could do it through mirroring. You could also do it through, like, I think Chromecast. Like, you know, they have that little dongle. It's only like $35.
Or yeah, I have that too.
Directly. I like hook up my Surface directly with an HDMI cable.
You do.
Yes, my Surface. My Apple products, I mirror with the Surface. I just hook it up directly.
Because would you lose anything if you're mirroring using AirPlay versus using a cable, a hard connection? Do you lose any quality or latency?
I think as long as you have a decent network, I think that they both put it through in high def, so I don't think it would matter.
So on
theoretically, you could have a bottleneck in the Wi-Fi that you would probably never see in a hard connection, but they're both capable of doing high definition.
And I have an old MacBook, so I need to get an adapter for that HDMI cable because it's an
import. you need sort of the Thunderbolt to HDMI converter.
There's a huge story on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2014, in the New York Times by Gardner Harris. It's called "Medicines Made in India Set Off Safety Worries." As a result, I've heard I heard an amazing segment on Diane Rehm. You wrote a piece for this at CNN.com. Asked you to write a piece for this about our prescription drugs. It's titled "How Safe Are Your Prescription Drugs?" This is kind of a, I guess it's not. Maybe it's a. I don't know if you knew about this issue yourself.
I mean, I sort of vaguely knew, but I had no idea it was this bad.
Go ahead, tell us what the issue is.
So, you know, like everything, we keep outsourcing our production to other countries, and a lot of generic drugs, and in fact, a lot of prescription drugs in general are being more and more put together in other countries. Now, this is I started the piece by I'm always sort of baffled by, you know, anytime we have a controversy about, you know, seniors wanting to go to Canada to get their drugs. Or you know, they want to pass a bill that says we should be able to buy our drugs from Canada. You see a lot of people immediately start freaking out that how do we know they're safe and everything else. And it's like, okay, you know what? Canada is a first world nation, and all of our drugs are pretty much made somewhere else. We do very little production of drugs in the United States because, like everything else, they get made in countries where it's much cheaper to put the stuff together. And a lot of our drugs these days are put together in India, are put together in China, and those countries can do it much more cheaply. And all always know deep down inside, like, you get what you pay for. But, you know, I think there's this hope that, like, well, we can just have cheap labor in India and everything else. But as part of recent FDA legislation, they actually started demanding some extra fees for approval of generic drugs and other drugs, which got put into a pile that they were going to start using for enforcement and for doing some spot checks. And so in the last year or two, they've actually been doing a lot of traveling to India to look at the quality of the facilities that are putting these drugs together. And it's the results have been, like, shockingly horrific that that they've been, you know, looking at how the drugs are going, and they've been doing all of these checks, and they find, you know, filthy facilities. They find that the drugs are not necessarily pure. There have been reports in other countries, and in the United States for that matter, of counterfeit drugs, or drugs actually that wound up hurting people. And when they went to a lot of these facilities in India, a huge percentage of them had problems and were either fined or shut down. And there were even some CEOs who were found guilty of fraud for lying to the FDA. I mean, you should go read the New York Times story because it's unbelievable. But, you know, part of the problem is that these drug companies are like, well, we can't do this. India's freaking out because it's a multi-billion-dollar industry for them, and all these pharmaceutical companies are now pulling out because it turns out, well, the way that they were doing it so cheaply was by cutting corners. And the pharmaceutical companies are like, well, we can't take the risk, and two, well, if they fix it, it won't be cheap anymore. So they're picking up and moving out of India, which is a real problem, and unfortunately, a lot of them are now moving to China, where we don't have the ability to inspect. And this was the horrifying part at the end of the article, was that, you know, India allows our inspectors in. China does not. While we've sort of asked and we've tacitly gotten approval, they've not, I think, issued yet any of the visas that are necessary for our inspectors to go look. But now they're the sort of cheap producer of choice. And there's a real issue. It's like, you know, we worry about bringing drugs in from Canada, but we're bringing drugs in from other, you know, overseas all the time with no thought. Just we imagine that because they're crossing into our borders that we have done the oversight and that we have done the due diligence to prove that they are safe. That's not always happened. And when we started doing it in India, we found horrible problems. And when we start doing it in China, we have no idea what we will find, but we're not doing it. And we don't know, you know, necessarily what is going on with a lot of these drugs that are being produced overseas. And we assume,
well, is this generally just the generics?
Well, I think that there's, you know, a lot more. I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. It's like, I don't know. I mean, I hesitate to say that one way or the other because I don't know. But I think probably, and again, I'm guessing here, that some of the more name brand drugs, they, you have to remember that when they're doing business, they're the only producer of it. So they probably do a lot more diligence of making sure everything works because, you know, if there was a problem, they would get crushed. And so they probably keep the facility, they probably own the production facilities. They probably, you know, are much more concerned because they don't want anyone else to know sort of the proprietary information of how all this works. When you get into generics, at that point, sort of anybody can make them as long as they can prove it's bioequivalent. And so at that point, there's probably a lot more outsourcing and putting around because at that, you know, they're just looking for whoever can make this drug the most most cheaply and the most easily. And so I think that the way the drug production works is different with the generic market than with the over-the-counter market than with you know, drugs that are more name brand and are, you know, under patent exclusivity at the beginning. But the potential is theoretically there, I suppose.
A lot more to get to with our guest, Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. Are you following him? Two R's, two L's. Also, read him at The Incidental Economist. He's got a great post right now, quite a few. We've talked about a couple of them already. Titled, Where's All the Outrage About Rationing in Private Insurance? Wait, you're telling me private insurance rations? We'll find out what Aaron Carroll. I'm teasing here.
I get so upset about it, I can't help myself.
I'll reset when we come back, but you can't interrupt while I tease.
Sorry.
We'll find out if there's rationing in private insurance when we return with more conversation and your calls for Dr. Aaron Carroll. We'll be right back.
Stand up with Pete Dominic. You're listening to a radio bumper for a show. Now some music, then talking.
we are back with Dr. Aaron Carroll and your phone calls. He blogs at The Incidental Economist. He tweets at Aaron E. Carroll. He's a YouTube sensation now. His videos have received over 1 million views. Healthcare triage. Congratulations on that. That is really impressive. You do a great job of those videos. I'm disappointed with how good you are at that, actually.
Thank you.
Frustrates me. You have a lot of nice shirts also.
Ah,
seems like you do a lot of shopping. I'm not going to lie.
I do no shopping. That's all Amy.
Your wife buys your clothes for you?
Oh, hell yes. I'm terrible at that stuff.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
My wife has never bought, I don't think, like maybe like a Christmas, a couple shirts here and there.
I bought almost nothing for myself, I would say.
All right, we've got a couple phone calls I want to get to, but I got to ask you about this post about, it's titled, Where's All the Outrage About Rationing in Private Insurance? And I also wanted to ask you about the tax write-off that the private insurance industry gets. I know Jonathan Gruber has been talking about that, and if you didn't give a write-off to employer-based health insurance, that would raise about $250 billion in tax revenue here. But,
other than the mortgage deduction, that's like one of the biggest tax expenditures we have.
I think it might be bigger.
I think the mortgage is the biggest, but I'm not positive.
Let's talk about the rationing of private insurance. I'll get to the phone call.
Okay, let's do it. So, you know, I was reading a story in the New York Times just a couple days ago that was talking about, changes to Medicare Part D, where they're trying to reduce some spending by saying that, like, you know, there are certain drugs that maybe we shouldn't be covering. Because right now, basically, if a drug exists, they cover it with sort of no thought to cost or everything else. They just sort of cover a percentage and that how it works. So they're trying to find ways to allow, you know, some of the insurers. And remember, it's private insurance companies that administer Medicare Part D, but to give them some coverage so that they can limit the overuse of some drugs, such as prescribed antipsychotic drugs in nursing home patients with dementia, which is widely viewed as inappropriate, but is still, you know, done quite a bit. And also saying, like, maybe they don't need to cover all drugs without doing, you know, so at least trying some of the cheaper ones first. And advocacy groups started screaming and yelling. Everybody started saying, look, there's the government, it's rationing. Everyone started, you know, sort of getting upset. Hospital groups got upset. The nursing homes group got upset. You know, all the neurologists, everybody got upset. How dare you ration? How dare you tell a patient that they can't have what they want? This is government at its worst. This is the way that, you know, the end of times begins, where they start telling you that you can't have stuff. And I've seen these articles before, and usually when I see an article like this, I write a piece along the lines of, like, this is why we can't ever have, you know, comprehensive reform to reduce healthcare spending, because, of course, one man's waste is another man's access or quality or something like that. So, you know, we recognize generally that this is an area where we overspend, but any time we try to cut it, someone loses their mind. But instead, actually, when I kept reading the article, it had a little bit of truth that sort of snuck through there, where it said they're modeling this on what private insurance does. Because private insurance all the time, any one of us who has private insurance knows, they're formularies. And they say, you can have this drug, but you can't have that drug. And if you want to have that drug, you're going to pay a whole lot more for it, because, you know, we're not going to pay for this drug. And basically, this was trying to give Medicare the same tools that we use every day in private insurance. And I'm sort of just was struck by the hypocrisy of, why is this rationing and government at its worst when Medicare does it, but when private insurance does it, no one cares. There's no protest. There's no screaming by advocacy groups attacking the private insurance industry for, you know, covering one drug and not another. It's only when government does this that we get incredibly upset. When private insurance does the exact same thing, there's no worries about rationing or difficulties there. And I'm sort of, I've seen this before. We've talked about this before. In the same way that Medicare is, American is apple pie if you're 65, but it's a communist end of days scenario if you're 64. it baffles me sometimes the way that we are somewhat hypocritical in the way that we view health policy and how insurance works.
Got to ask you about this thing that's getting a lot of attention. I just saw on CNN they had a family and polio-like vaccine in California. What do we know?
Well, no, it's polio-like disease, not vaccine. Got to be careful there.
Why did I say vaccine?
I don't know. No, be careful. Vaccine's fine. Yeah.
Hey, I am a professional broadcaster, and I don't make mistakes. I don't need to be corrected. I know what I said, and I meant it.
Well, when Jenny McCarthy is now screaming that the polio shot gives polio because of you.
Oh, God.
So – they're seeing a new illness. They don't know exactly what's causing it. They don't know what's doing it, but it is sort of polio-like. It is small. It is worth watching. I would not freak out yet. The CDC is on it. The media, as always, is sort of grabbing it and making it sensationalistic, but we don't know what's going on yet, and it is still at this time small. And you have to remember that outbreaks of disease happen all over the world in small amounts, very bad things. We all panic. The vast majority are contained and go away. And then we have to be vigilant. But as always, be vigilant. Good hand washing, good procedures. We should keep an eye on what's going on. But at this point, it is small. And I would not want to sort of sensationalize any more than it is already being done.
Chad is calling from Boston. Chad, you're on Stand Up.
Hi, Pete and Dr. Carroll. How are you guys doing today?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. I had a question, Dr. Carroll, primarily for you. But, Pete, I don't know if you've talked about this on your show at all. The case out of Boston Children's Hospital involving a minor in a medical diagnosis dispute between Tufts Hospital and Boston Children's. Dr. Carroll, have you heard anything about this?
No. I mean, feel free to tell me about it, but I have not.
It's a fairly it's a complex case. It essentially boils down to. There was a 15-year-old girl who was, the Children's Hospital filed an allegation of medical abuse on the parents.
Okay.
And this was about a year ago.
Okay.
Because the child had received a diagnosis from Tufts Hospital of mitochondrial disease.
Okay.
And the doctor, she was referred to a specialist at Children's, and even before she was able to see the specialist, she was diagnosed, I think, with somatoform disorder. Anyway, this has been going on for a year. The parents are from Connecticut. They haven't been able to have, they've had very limited visitations, court cases, you know, that have been, you know, in court. Department of Children and Families is taking custody of the child.
This sounds like a legal question.
Yeah, and all of that, it's like these cases are always so complicated. I hesitate. You have to remember that
the young girl named Justina Pelletier, parents of Justina Pelletier upset after learning teenager will now be sent to foster care, advocate says.
I don't like to sort of come down defending or not defending one side or the other, but I always sort of caution people to recognize that hospitals don't act as an entity. It is not one group. In order for the hospital to take action like this, you would have to have, you know, the vast majority of the physicians that care for this girl, the nurses that care for this girl, the social workers that have been involved in the case, everyone sort of touching you would have to be like on board. To sort of make this decision, because if it's not as if one person can go, hey, this is Munchausen's by proxy, rip this, you know, take away parental rights and do all this stuff. There's so many people involved in the care of someone who has a chronic disease like this. They'd all sort of have to be on board with the idea that the parents were doing or something, or that in order for this to move forward in this direction. And I've seen this happen rarely before, but when it does, there's a general consensus and a feeling. And even then, law has to, you know, CPS, the Child Protective Services, has to get involved, in which case now city officials are involved and state officials are involved. So it is not like you got a parent versus a hospital administrator and it's a he said, she said story. Having said that, I don't know the particulars of the case. I'm sure none of us do. I'm sure it's much more complicated than you're going to get a sense of in the media, and I don't know. But
the Boston Globe has done a really deep dive into this in a two-part series on it. So if people want to know more about
Chad, I'll look forward to reading it because I'm sure.
Yeah, maybe
sure
a question for Eric Siegel tomorrow too, because you know we're going to be talking with him tomorrow, and you know there's.
I'm curious. Does the Boston Globe come down on the side like this is the hospital overreaching, or is it the parents? What did they say?
I don't know. I don't even know what the hell the case is. The issue is.
I will have
what they're upset about. But I wanted to ask you also about the liberal blogosphere, at least in terms of Michael Hiltzik and Paul Krugman, who are columnists, not bloggers, but also maintain blogs. At least in Krugman's case, you've got Jonathan Chait. You've got a number of kind of liberal health policy folks that talk about healthcare. all talking about, you know, debunking all of the right-wing conservative episodes of examples of Obamacare nightmares. And they're saying, well, they can't even find any for real. I mean, there are plenty of people that have lost their health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act, that some of which have to pay more in premiums. But yet the bottom line is the ones that the, you know, right wing, the Koch funded, you know, special interest groups and all those organizations, as well as the congresswomen members themselves who are trotting these people out. Those have oftentimes, those specific examples have been debunked. And if only this person would have looked into it, they would have understood that the Affordable Care Act offers a lot of options. But right.
I think that the problem is that they want a home run, and therefore they're overreaching. They want to find someone who is not of great means, so perhaps in the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, but also has, you know, is ill and will be sympathetic and will be screwed by the law. And the truth of the matter is that that person is apocryphal, because poor people are going to get the Medicaid expansion. They're going to get free insurance. And even then, people who are very close to poor are going to get massive subsidies. So it's going to be very hard to find someone screwed in that respect. There are people who are, you know, going to be harmed by the law. For instance, we've talked before about the bros. But you have to therefore find like a 27-year-old healthy male who has a job that pays him like $60,000 but doesn't provide him health insurance. That kid is going to be screwed, but that kid's not going to be very sympathetic when you wheel him out, because he's got an awesome job, he's healthy, he's young, and he's still going to have to pay, I don't know, a couple hundred, you know, $100-$150 a month for insurance. It's not a horror story. It's a, okay, yes, that person exists, but I'm not going to identify with him. And so, yeah, these people exist. They will also probably find people, you know, in families who perhaps make six figures, who, you know, now have to pay more for health insurance than they could before, because, you know, they were perfectly healthy and they were able to get a great deal. But again, they're perfectly healthy. And so when you wheel them out, it's like, well, am I supposed to really feel bad for this guy making a six-figure income who now has to pay a bit more for health insurance? That again, it exists, but it's not a terribly sympathetic story. Anyone who's sick is almost by definition going to do well, because they now have guaranteed issue community-rated insurance. So they're going to do better. And so I think what it is that they cannot find people who have been screwed by the law that also would be a great political sympathetic person for an ad. And in order to find someone who fits what they think would resonate, they have to really stretch it, and those stories are debunked. Because again, people with terrible chronic illnesses are going to do better. People who are poor are going to do better. You know, people who were previously uninsured are going to do better. And it is therefore difficult to find someone who fits the mold of what they're looking for, who also would wind up having a story that held up under scrutiny.
Now, I know you took an Alec Baldwin, like, I'm not going to argue in this anymore stance a few weeks back about the Affordable Care Act and not getting into the everyday back and forth of it. But that's not exactly what we're doing here. I mean, the argument that I want to ask you about is, what are the, you know, what are the stats right now? You made a really articulate and great point about, hey, this plan, this policy shouldn't really be judged until we've had it in place, yeah. Fully
well,
in place
I
for at least
I
a couple
would,
of years.
Yeah.
But
I would say that was not an Alec Baldwin-like stance.
A very Alec Baldwin-like. Dr. Carroll recently called a member of Paparazzi a cocksucker. And, who was taking pictures of him and his family. You know, Aaron Carroll has become very famous from being on this program regularly, and so Paparazzi follows him around. The enrollment numbers, that's what everybody likes to focus on, enrollment numbers. And they
right.
haven't met their goal, or they've exceeded their goal. It depends who you're talking to, with which argument they're rolling out. Where do you...
Yeah, I mean, they did great in January. They didn't do as well in February. And this is exactly what I mean. It's like, this is the same thing as, like, it's a full circle. It's like picking the obesity stats and cherry-picking one and then making that the headline news. It's like, they did great in January. Does that mean the Affordable Care Act is an awesome thing with no mistakes? No. They didn't do as well in February. Does that mean the Affordable Care Act is a horrible failure and we should scrap it and repeal it? No. You know, these are snapshots. And the law is not meant to be judged on a month-to-month basis or a day-to-day basis. It's just not how we do health policy.
Well, that doesn't help the news cycle.
It's not how we judge Medicare. It's not how we judge Medicaid. It's not how we judge private insurance. It's just not how health policy is done. And so that will be the media's, you know, they got to talk about something. They got to talk about something every day.
We always like to help at least one or two people when you're here. And let's help Joy in California. We've got less than 3 minutes, so maybe we can do this. Maybe we can. I hate to rush anybody, but go ahead, Joy.
Hi. I signed up for Blue Shield after I was told by Blue Shield that they would cover my doctor. And now I'm finding out that my doctor said that Blue Shield isn't covering anyone.
Right.
And it's gotten really bad. And there's all kinds of people who are getting, all kinds of doctors who are getting shafted. And in the meantime, patients are.
Yes. You know, I think there have been a number of stories of people who have just taken what insurance companies are telling them at their work. So a lot of these stories that make the news are like the insurance company tells people, hey, if you want to keep this policy, your premium's going to double, and that's the fault of Obamacare. And they keep it, and they sign up, and then they find, and then the story turns out to be later that, well, they could have gone to the exchanges and gotten something much better for much cheaper.
I went to the exchange.
Well, but so if you're telling me that Blue Shield told you something and it turned out not to be true.
Let me explain it a little bit better. I signed up for Undercover California.
Okay.
I called Blue Shield and said, okay, here's my doctor. I want to make sure that I am covered with you guys if I go with you. And they said, yes, you are.
Well, someone wasn't telling
you
the truth.
And then I called my doctor and I double-checked, and they said, yeah, we're going to take it. But then afterwards, my doctors apparently didn't take it because Blue Shield wasn't paying.
Well, okay, that was a negotiation between your doctors and Blue Shield, and they shouldn't have told you they were taking it.
Well, it's happening to all kinds of people.
Yeah, but they signed contracts. They signed contracts. This is not – they can't make a decision on a daily basis.
No, you don't understand. They have done this almost completely with every single Blue Shield patient.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying, but doctors will negotiate with insurance companies about whether to accept their insurance and all their patients. They can do this on a yearly basis. They can do this on a multi-year basis. Right now, they're probably doing it yearly. But your doctor, if they were in negotiations and still not knowing whether they were going to accept Blue Shield patients for the next year, they should have told you so when you were debating what insurance to sign up for. It sounds like they told you they were going to accept it, and then they decided not to.
Yeah. Well, they were going to accept it.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Joy. Thank you very much for the call. Sorry we didn't get to a full conclusion on that. As always, thank you very much, Aaron.
Anytime.
At Aaron E. Carroll, everybody. Give him a follow on Twitter. Harass him there. Read his blog, The Incidental Economist. And watch and share his videos on YouTube, HC Triage, Healthcare Triage. They are phenomenal and at debunking things and teaching you things. And you got to check them out.